Hello and welcome back to the Research VR, everybody. I am your host, Oswald Abanian, and with me today are two new special guests, Craig Douglas and Tom Buchanan from Context AI. Hello, everybody. I'm giving you a
hello.
Clap, clap, clap in VR. Welcome to the podcast. I know you are new to the listeners, but you are not new to me, at least Craig. Well, hello, guys. You guys are from Context CI. CI standing for...
Yep. Control Interface. By the way, hello. Appreciate everyone. Glad to be on. Thank you for having us, Oz.
That's right.
But yeah, Context CI as in contact with control interfaces. So specifically, we're kind of alluding to using a human-computer interface to make contact or touch with that digital world.
Ooh, you said the three buzz letters that I really like, actually. HCI. I guess that's where it came from, didn't it? Yeah, you just took out the H, the haptic, the human-computer interaction to contact. And in terms of interaction, what are we talking about here? This is, what are you building?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we're really focused on is touch within interaction. So there's a lot of facets of that that are like kind of important subtleties, but we're really focused on the simulating that sense of touch within your fingers. So not trying to give a body sensation, but if you are tapping, just like we're in big screen right now, if I were to tap along this table, being able to actually feel that like it's tangibly there. Mm-hmm. Or when you grip onto your tablet the same way, like with the Vive controller, I grab with the button, having the ability to have that object that's in the digital presence right there detect that you're making the interaction and give you a simulated sense of touch on your fingers.
So this, I guess, the touch simulator that you're putting on, essentially kind of like a glove, correct?
Definitely, absolutely.
I know you're trying to avoid saying that word, but sorry to throw it in there.
No, actually, really, we don't really try and avoid the glove wording, to be honest, ourselves. Okay. I mean, I know you've actually put on multiple generations of the glove prototypes. Sure. Part of why kind of just in the overarch when we talk about the, I guess, mission or goal with what we're doing, we don't want the long term to be tied to a specific type of motion capture, in the sense that we want the whatever is the best kind of technology available in the motion capture world on gesture recognition to be able to interface with the haptic side themselves. Right now, we've accomplished that best through a glove, but we've got some early experiments and kind of things in our roadmap that are focused more on some of like the computer vision, like even just as simple as Elite Motion with then just like our haptic hardware rather than having the tracking hardware that's in the glove itself there. So right now, our best method and our units that are out in with testers and in developers' hands are gloves. And we just see a lot of positives that come from them and a large chance that those are the dominant hand-based interfacing device of the next 10 years of VR. But we also understand that there may be some better motion captures out there or developed in that time period that we want to make sure our touch works with.
Awesome.
We're just making our whole system like a tracking agnostic, really.
And the problem that you're trying to solve clearly is the lack of touch and the lack of hand interaction. And I think, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but
So we're solving the lack of touch. Our systems are, like we've been talking about, glove based right now because of we want to be able to get at the time some of the best hand tracking just wasn't available enough. So we built the whole system in, but now as these better hand tracking methods are getting out into the public and easier to develop for, we're building our touch systems, which is our bread and butter, on top of those more refined hand tracking solutions.
So like example, Elite Motion is, since the Orion update, a pretty phenomenal hand tracking device, to be honest. I mean, it doesn't do everything. There's obviously clear limitations in field of view and other aspects of it, but you didn't see the wide-scale adoption of it in developer community the same way you saw like when Touch came out from Oculus, in the sense that it didn't have that same support of knowing there was going to be a bunch of content and distribution behind it. And I think one of those things that really limited Leap Motion from getting to that in its earliest days was when a lot of people got those first devices around kind of DK2 era, and they went out and they went to reach and touch something, and you had that phantom grasp of trying to push on an object or pick up one of the blocks, and you weren't getting any type of tactile feedback or anything that was like kind of physically telling you there's an interaction happening here. So that, combined with the some of the gesture controls issues, or is a lot of why you didn't see overall applications developing those kinds of hand inputs into them. You also have seen from some of the other gloves that have been around more on like what would be called like a bend sensor or a flex sensor that's been in a lot of different data gloves since the 70s, actually even the late 60s is when the first prototype was built in an MIT lab. Those have also been limited by the fact that, okay, while you may be able to get a representative level of finger movement, missing that second half of the most important part of your hand interaction kind of limits what the potential it has itself there. So there's just exponentially more that you can do when you have both that gesture tracking and that touch working in tandem together. And we really are trying to make sure that we can provide that touch part of it. We've done a lot of work on our own motion tracking stuff. I mean, you've seen some of the gloves that had just actually motion tracking only in them. Mm. We've developed an entire exotendit motion capture based system. So kind of taking a little bit more of the like hands anatomy as inspiration for how we want to track based off of the way the tendons lay out within it, rather than just kind of a pure electrical approach that you have like kind of with the bend sensors or a pure computer vision approach with the, you know, the Kinect or the Leap or those. And we've seen a lot of good success with that, but we have also seen that there are barriers to adoption being labeled in just one motion capture method. You know, say an end game of a headset, like maybe when Intel has, you know, their full head.
Whoa.
Did I go? Did I leave? Sorry about that.
No worries.
That's my fault. Don't blame the wonderful Oz or Tom for that, people of the research community. It was clearly Craig's fault.
The problem that we just had is that Craig accidentally touched the button on his UI, essentially the virtual UI in the air, and teleported us to another environment, and kind of proving your own point in terms of like how important touch is to intent. Mm-hmm. And or at least to even understand.
Completely not on purpose.
Yeah, you totally planned this out. This is a no, I'm joking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mid-sentence interrupt myself by
let's focus a little bit on like how the you mentioned exo what was the term you were using?
Exotendons. So that's not a
exotendons, yeah.
Do you want to take that, Tom?
Yeah, sure. So Craig mentioned exotendons. And what that is, it was a system that really we started at the very beginnings of our development. We wanted to build both our motion capture and our haptic systems based off of this exotendon methodology. And what it is it's very similar to like the biomimetic approach of like planes being built after birds, and just based on building technology off of how nature has really developed it.
And some biomimicry.
So our exotendon approach was taken. Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. Biomimicry. So that was what the approach was, to take the same way that your arms use muscles and tendons to control your fingers and hands, and replace and replicate that system into our device to use that for the motion capture and the haptics. And so that is something that for a while we were developing on, but like Craig mentioned, for the wider spread adoption through developers, because we wanted to focus specifically on the haptics, we also moved towards trying these different hand tracking methods, from flex sensors to your Leap motions to your other solutions. But we still do continue to employ some of the exotendon system to do that actual force feedback haptics. So with in our demo right now that we're working on, you've tried it, you interact with an object with your hand and you'll feel a basic vibration to signify your first moment of interaction, and a pullback to give that direction to the vector, whereas like the vibrations giving the magnitude, the pullback of the force feedback completes the full vector of the interaction.
You guys are very intricate. And can you explain that again, actually, in terms of the vector, like you were calling the vector of action?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about it, like a vector has both magnitude and direction. Okay. And the basic vibration has been put into various motion tracking gloves and solutions at points, right. And it's great at doing magnitude, but the direction is sometimes a little bit more difficult to add, depending on the level of interaction. And so by combining it with our force feedback system, so our force feedback system, it actually pulls back on your degrees of freedom of your hand when you interact with these objects. So that provides the direction of the interaction to complete that vector.
Got it. That's a good explanation, actually. So in terms of how the actual the exotendons work. What are you guys doing there? You have certain strings that are running down into your finger that are pulling back to simulate, you know, that's forced feedback. And
yep, exactly. So a lot of different methods have been attempted to accomplish force feedback, but we're particularly focused on that exotendon approach that is based on how your own hands and fingers work to give that direction part of the interaction. So it runs along the hands back until we have a small housing placed on your forearm, which then is the control unit. And then that is where all the processing takes place and then talks to the system.
Cool. And I think, let me get this right, actually. I'm pretty sure you guys were one of the earliest controller that had a Vive tracker on it to do the positional tracking, or am I right about that, Craig?
Yeah, so we were... We got one of the earlier Vive trackers sent through the developer batch before they were announced. And we were able to I'll take a couple steps back. We had done the SteamVR native tracking classes to build the tracking system directly into our housings and devices.
Okay.
And had some pretty great success with that in just developing and putting that into our system. But right around the same time was when the Vive tracker was coming out.
Mm.
And just to interject, I guess, a little bit, that's a bit what I think what you're referring to, Oz, of we were publicly the first non-HTC license of SteamVR that showed a peripheral working. So from those classes that they'd opened up that fall, when we had posted a video, I think it was actually like a week or two before CES, some of the guys over at I think it was Ian Hamilton, I think, that pointed out to us that, hey, I don't think we've seen anything like this out yet from the classes. And at that time, we kind of retroactively realized that we'd become the first to publicly show that working outside of the HTC teams, with obviously being a licensee of SteamVR themselves with the year exclusivity and giant corporation headset on our small team.
Dude, that's awesome. I'm sure you guys are pretty happy.
Yeah, no, it was extremely fun to kind of work with that whole SteamVR environment and building it into your own systems.
Is that mainly the form of tracking that you guys use is through Lighthouse?
For personal,
the Vive tracker, it's just been extremely convenient to be able to slap the pucks right on top of your housings and track it space and develop through just the platform.
And some of that is convenience on the engineering side. Some of it is also, business development politics, in the sense that like Oculus's constellation tracking isn't out in any type of public way. It isn't available for any kind of application that has a licensee to develop. So that's kind of where, if we have the support system from a company like Valve that's wanting people to be using their leading tracking solution, it makes it a bit easier for us to be, as a company working with that versus one, wanting it to be much more walled off. And there is, of course, the other options from doing larger kind of marker systems like you have in your traditional kind of warehouse trackings, or using some of the other things that you've seen in kind of experiments from maybe like Samsung's Rink, which was only really showed off at like one conference with a magnetic positional sensor. Mm. Things like that have been looked at. But since we know we're really focusing on that haptic, that sense of touch, we would rather just use what the platforms are validating as their end game or what their current use case of that positional tracking themselves are. And since the best performing of that and most available is SteamVR, that's kind of been kind of a no-brainer for us to really focus on that one. We actually originally even were doing it with the Vive controller strapped onto our device. So the first, I think that was E3 2016, the first glove that we showed publicly working in VR and tracking and giving you, at that point, just pretty shoddily working vibration on the fingertips. It was a 2.5 pound glove versus now what we're testing with is substantially under a pound and a much smaller frame and a much higher level of functionality, having those force feedback as well as a more developed vibration haptic system on top of those tracking system that's in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of using a headset and having a glove be the smallest form factor, I see only Lighthouse being able to achieve to the same extent what you could. But beyond that, I mean, in terms of some of the clients that you've been working with, like what are their setups that I think or are notable that you kind of have to design around?
Definitely. I mean, I think the first obvious one is, of course, is Constellation, right? That's how Rift is tracked with there. So, you know, putting in the array of how they have their sensors lined up to be within that. And then the other most obvious one is, of course, using what PlayStation does with the light matching through the Move controllers. That's actually a mostly more of a quality of tracking solution that we've part of for that one. It's got some really high robustness for what it does on its specific end, but putting it on a thing that has much higher occlusion becomes a lot more difficult. There's other ones that are out there in the sense of, like, if you remember back at OC3, they had shown during Abrash's keynote a glove that was doing some tracking.
So
that's with OptiTrack. Yeah, so that's what I'm looking at. Exactly. There's other systems like PhaserLock or others that are similar to OptiTrack that you can put markers on and kind of it. The traditional full body motion capture to that same route, putting it as a fixed object there. There's some other like routes through IMUs and based off of like with an IMU that has a relative anchor point on your body and things like that. But that again gets more cumbersome in the ergonomic factors if you're putting something on your chest to give it a relative point to. There's some options like that. I think one I kind of slightly mentioned that I think was pretty interesting, but hasn't really been prevalently used in anything else was Samsung had shown a prototype device about a year and a half ago that used a magnetic field representation of its positional tracking. And there's been a lot of stuff on the computer vision side. Like, I mean, look at what you have from the hand positional that you get inside the RealSense from Intel or things like that. Give example of what you can see from like a consumer version, a computer vision version of positional tracking. But there's just nothing that's as accurate or as robust as TeamVR right now.
Yeah, you have anything to add to that?
No, I think you covered all the kind of key points, so just like from the use cases, all the different technologies that kind of go into it. And I mean, it's just for the level that we're at and being able to turn out iterations as fast as possible, this TeamVR is just, it's a no-brainer.
I think they really put their bets on the right technology, like Valve earlier on when they wanted to know how to support and like not just create something but actually create a entire an economy or a biome of developers that can that are not only using their software but now licensing their hardware. I think much better place to be than being the OEM that's actually manufacturing these headsets, because then you'll have to compete with so many others.
Absolutely. And I very much agree with you there. I think that's a good point of kind of explaining how our goal or our vision for our model is intended to work. It's very similar to kind of how the SteamVR license is, it's in the HTC headset and it's in the LG headset that's coming up. And they've got some other ones that are not necessarily as like publicly announced, or there's things that are working with SteamVR on the peripheral side, or, you know, people from like just all the way down to a smaller startup like ourselves working in those classes and getting on that end. The way that they are not confined to which headset, but which headset wants to use the best technology solution as in their backend component. That's really how we see the touch component of not Oculus touch controllers, but the touch component of a haptic device being able to be provided for multiple headset platforms in kind of a mass consumer way further down the line. Not us building a individual glove that we mass consume and sell on the shelves as a, you know, you're going to Amazon and buying your Rift and you're buying your Context CI glove to then work with it as the third-party controller, but more you're going and you're buying your Oculus, you know, bundle that has a controller with this touch technology inside of it, the same way you buy your HTC bundle with the Valve SteamVR technology doing the tracking inside of it. So that's why we use a lot of understanding of, okay, if SteamVR is the best positional, we want to work with that right now. The same way that we see the market kind of continuing to pick up traction on that from other sides of showing that the component itself working with all the other leading market standards would be the easiest way for those OEMs to be able to see it integrating into what is maybe their future controller.
Right. I think to kind of sum it all together in terms of all these components and things that you're describing, the experience of wearing one, I think I can kind of help paint that picture a little bit for our listeners. So with I guess the exotendons are really good for is being able to pull certain parts of your fingers back when you're touching an edge of a table. Yep. Not only that, you have, I guess, these vibration motors in the front that when you do touch the table, you know, you have the touch, and then you also, if you try and push your hand through it, you have the pull of your fingers.
Definitely. Yeah,
that edge detection is something that is kind of completely unknown in VR to you know, as far as I can tell, you don't really have that even with any of the Vive or Rift controllers. And yeah, the first, I think I've tried a few different iterations of the haptic, or you know, the glove, let's just say. But or actually, do you have a more technical name for the product itself?
So we've called our product Maestro, as in like the glove that is out right now is Maestro Alpha. In this in the way that we've always called our glove package as a product Maestro. I guess on the haptic side, we just refer to it as either force feedback or vibration specifically. And in the future, that would then also include whatever haptics on top of that we're able to develop and incorporate into that IP license.
Got it.
So it'd be Maestro Alpha for short. Sorry.
Yeah, and kind of calling the interactions we're bringing is more of like a natural touch interaction.
Yes. Yeah, that's, we're trying to use that terminology for, you know, that's what your finger is allowing you to have a natural touch based experience. You know, when you're pushing on that table, or you're fingering like across a paint canvas to do a finger painting, or you are, you know, moving an object across a virtual desk because you need, you know, to see what this one lined up to that one is. We want you to have that natural feeling that you would be pushing against a physical object itself. Right now, we don't have anything that would, you know, simulate weight with that. Obviously, we don't have because it is all self-contained, right? The unit is in a glove on your hand. There's no external force factor similar to gravity that is, you know, a robotic arm holding you back, like maybe some of the 200,000 type devices that you'll see in research labs doing some force feedback might have. But we're trying to do it in what could be all completely contained in the hand's ergonomic factor there. And I think one thing that's important as part of that is, Tom was mentioning like using the vibration and the force feedback together and completing, you know, the full vector of forces that you're feeling and interaction type. I think that's part of what our, I guess, development roadmap is, continuing to find ways that we can add more of those parts of factors of force that go into the sense of touch. So like comparatively to what's out there in a device that's kind of our size or even our price point, there's really nothing else doing maybe more than one, two of those factors of force. There's really, people say up to about 15. According to some researchers, like a shout out to our good friends at SynTouch, who are doing a robotic fingertip. They're trying to work on making what would be the RGB of touch classifications. They categorize it as 15 factors of force that are felt on your fingertip, whether that be if something has like a stiffness, whether that be like the level of amplitude of texture you would feel as you drag across it, the direction of friction, if something is slimy or not, if something has temperature to it, if something has like the ability to condense as you put more pressure into it, so the way of like a rubber duck does, things like that are all different, like subtle factors that we're not close to adding all 15 of those in. But what we've seen so far in early prototypes and testings of other things, we are further along than anything else we've seen on getting the highest number of those factors into that sense of touch together there.
That's an interesting point, I think, in terms of trying to create an RGB classification, or at least like a multi-dimensional classification, because a lot of the times you wouldn't just feel one of those. It would be a combination of different magnitudes on each. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean,
the finger itself has a ton of this ridiculous subtleties. I mean, if you look at, there's a group of Swedish scientists that have put out a report that's been pretty well, like, I guess, received in the community would be the way to say it. That they found that your fingertip itself, like kind of in the fingerprint area, can measure as small as like 13 millimeters of amplitude. So basically, an easier way to kind of visualize that would be if your fingertip was the size of planet Earth, and it, you know, dragged across another planet Earth-sized object, you would be able to feel the difference between when you went over top of a house comparatively to a car, at that size of scale of an object. So like, take that to your fingertip dragging across like this kitchen table. If it was physical, you know, you feel a piece of salt, you feel a piece of, you know, leftover seasoning from the dinner before. Those are kind of the extreme subtleties that we wouldn't be able to do right now, but our, I guess, where our long-term goal of why we want to make sure we can, you know, build up as much of an R&D kind of focused team around IP development or touch is getting to that point that you have that full levels of natural ability so that, you know, your finger itself does feel like you naturally have touched a physical object.
Yeah, that fine-grained resolution, I think, will probably... actually, why don't we go into why, you know, there are limiting... where are we limited by with some of this haptic technology? Yeah, I mean, apart from exotendons, how are people been approaching the problem of haptics? And perhaps we can start talking about it from one of the earliest devices that uses any of this, which is the Nintendo Power Glove, the infamous glove. What did they do?
So the Power Glove is actually pre-cemented in the middle of the Data Glove timeline. To be honest, it's more of like it was the first mass consumer release, but that was about like 84, I believe, right when that came out. The first patent that was granted to a gesture tracking device within a glove was in 1972 to Thomas Zimmerman, and that was the original bend sensor. So that actually had originally gloves there. They had no type of haptic solution at all because they were just trying to get the finger tracking, and that's actually where a lot of the industry is still focused. You've had some experiments that have been more on like kind of the robotics side, in the sense of in the 90s, there was a company named CyberGlove that came about that they're still operating today, doing phenomenal bend sensor gloves. They have a kind of a whole line of interaction devices that have found a home in kind of like movie studio motion capture or like R&D labs or things like that. They do use an outside robotic arm to implant force onto your hand, but they do have like kind of an exoskeleton on the outside of your fingers that can also kind of give a bit of pullback from that. Its limitation there is one, ergonomic factors of having a full robotic hand on your hand, you know, that's heavy and cumbersome and yada yada down the line. And two, having it tethered to a robotic hand that has to already be on your desk, that then limits the number of use cases and applications because, you know, you're stuck to being in seated one spot, one level of where your arm movements. It takes away the whole versatility of the human hand by being able to reach out and do different things because you're locally focused. And then otherwise, there's been some others that are kind of like that type of skeleton-based force feedback. So like, you know, one that's more recent would be a glove out of a German engineering company named Festo. They've been around since the very early 1900s, do a lot of actually biomimicry in some of their inspirational devices. They do a lot of like kind of autonomous and robotics development. They've got some really awesome like, you know, bionic ants out there that you can work as a hive, controlling them all together, things like that, or some robotic fish that could be used for exploratory stuff deep in the ocean. And early 2000s, they had put a lot of money into building a glove that could be used for like workforce to increase strength in the factory. They got held up in the sense that it used pneumatic pistons for generating that force that you would pull back on, giving kind of extra strength to the hand. And they've got some really cool prototypes, but again, is very localized in that it's attached to too many outside things that are not on your actual body. And it actually, an even more expensive device than, you know, previously, because they were building it in the sense of an engineering firm with what we can show is the best possible, not necessarily what we commercialize.
Sure.
And then outside of those, like kind of, I guess that would be like force feedback directly on your hand. You've had some more specific external arms that have found really good use cases in the medical world. So there's a lot of some training applications that, like, it's almost like an arm with like a stylus pen on the end of it that you grab that pen, and then it lets it feel like kind of like you'd be writing against a surface because the robotic arm holds the force against it outside of it, the same way that you would if you had like an external force that pen is pushing on. That's those types of like, that's one example of like kind of an external arm that has exerted force to give you almost that mixed reality haptic, right? Those have again been kind of limited in the sense of cost, application localization, and and that sort of realm of what has kept them in a research defined world, but also even not even really large scale side of that is mostly cost keeping those back. And then in the less like cumbersome based on the cost side, you would say most of the haptics industry for the longest period of time has been focused on vibration. So, I mean, like in your everyday applications right now, you experience haptic devices from your, you know, your tablets and your touch screens, you know, the vibration that you feel there, you know, in the years of like 2012 to 2016, really, there was a lot of conversation about how those touchscreens were getting so much better, so much more responsive for when you tapped on it. Even Apple like focused on, you know, having multidimensional touch as one of their key points of like, you know, you can sense when you're touching between two different things within one click. All of those types of little subtleties that can make those devices better, or more prevalently looking at kind of like the PlayStation DualShock controller. That was really one of the first like gaming at home devices that really focused on, okay, you can add a vibration inside of this to make you feel like the crowd's going wild when you're shooting a free throw during 2K, or, you know, when you pull the trigger during Call of Duty, you feel some sort of tactile, hello, this controller's here. You get even more immersed into it. I guess some of the other ways that people have looked at what would be like an in consumer haptic, you know, that you wouldn't hear the word, but you would know you're using it, like, arcades with like racing simulators have always added in, you know, a tug on the wheel to make it more realistic, like the tug that you get from your real life steering. So that would actually be a force feedback itself as well. So there's lots of small, like kind of prevalent applications like that. I mean, obviously the touchscreen market is not small. That's a giant application in the sense that everyone uses it every day and doesn't even, it's almost omnipresent and they don't notice how much it's affected their use of or improved use cases within those phones and those tablets without really having to call it out to them. That's really where we, I guess, the wrap back in of why we're focusing on the area of haptics we are, is that within spatial computing is going to be even more necessary. You know, the when we first went from an Xbox controller to a Vive wand, you exponentially increased your usability of VR spatial computing as a whole. When you then add that level of touch and finger tracking on top of that there, your interaction level, just the possibilities exponentially increase. It's, you know, it's hard to kind of actually even narrow how much there's increased ability. So that's why we've seen a lot of stuff developed in haptics that maybe aren't as maybe well known in the world as a haptic device. But I think human-computer interfacing with spatial computing will become even more prevalent and even more important for people to improve their quality of experience.
I think a really subtle indicator of how important haptics are to us, and I think this goes kind of like really under the radar when it comes to like usability and user interaction, but it leaves a memory that is really hard to like, you notice it a lot more when it's gone, is a lot with I think they call it the taptic engine, or maybe just the haptic engine.
Yeah, they do. Yep.
And they're so precise at, you know, creating feelings of buttons and pushes, to the point that obviously, like when they replaced the home button, they had that haptic replacement, and within a week or so, you just completely, you know, buy into it. And anytime you touch an iPhone's home button, when it's off, just it feels weird. It's like you expect a click and return, and you don't get it. But on the software, on the software side, like, when you integrate buttons and the feelings of buttons to specific UI and like interactions within an app, like the thing that I'm thinking about is liking in Twitter, you know, hearting something actually gives you that really real feedback, to the point that sometimes there might be a bug or something happens and just the haptic feedback doesn't register. And you're like, huh, that like that I gave that post felt kind of not as satisfying. Like,
All of VR right now is in that moment. To be fair, I mean, there's a lot of amazing interaction happening. I mean, there's even like some excellent, like excelling with what you can do with these controllers applications. You know, these are optimized for some specific applications, and they do have a small bit of either physicality in your hand or vibration haptics from like something that is tailored to that end and, you know, uses the software very well. But all of VR is in that moment right there, like you're saying with Twitter, where you didn't get that pushback of saying, hey, you actually clicked on that like. So you don't get that memory reinforcement of, hey, this object I did, which is why we consider training a giant application with, once you have actual like touch in here, you can have much more muscle memory and mind memory, hand-based skills that are taught and really remembered because you feel like, okay, I've done that before. Mm-hmm. I've picked that up and gotten hands-on with that digital object. So now I remember what it is to do it. So if I do it in a physical space, I can have a bit more of a recognition to that right away. So I guess, what I'm just saying is we want to get past that point to where people don't even know that they're not getting that like back from the feedback of hitting their Twitter like yet, because that's just where we are as an industry.
You know, with your glove, what you're going to be able to do is when you're watching a YouTube video, you're going to actually be able to smash that like button that they always tell you to do.
Absolutely.
Smash it. Maybe that's
the
interaction.
The Oculus Sports Challenge was one of the cooler things. It was like one of the first times I'd tried the touch controllers. And you had to actually enter the experience. You had to full on punch that start button, and it was a really satisfying experience being able to do that and feel like the haptics that are in the touch controller. So I think you're spot on.
I mean, I haven't played that sports game since like before the touch launched. I remember that was like a big deal.
Honestly, that game's pretty great with the hand interaction from touch. It definitely makes. I mean, like I remember playing the football game, you do feel much more cognitively present to be able to reach your hands up and grab the ball like you're catching it.
Totally.
Obviously, there was a bit of a learning curve of like, okay, do I grip onto this button or grip that button, rather than if I was able to feel like, oh, the ball hit my finger, now I squeeze down on it. But I digress. That was something I was very excited about when I saw the application working. I do think it's similar to when people say, you know, room scale ruined me from CDVR. I buy into that, but I don't think it fully took it completely away. But it changed our perception as an industry of what the application should be designed around, right? As a mainstream leading platform. And I very much believe that any type of sense added into spatial computing will do that same thing completely again in a kind of even more higher magnitude. So having touch in that type of application would completely change how you would think about designing it, or how you would think about what levels of sports interaction you could do, or why a user would not want to go back to doing it without that once they had the otherwise. So I think that's, I guess, showing why we also believe that it's just so important of an industry to be focused on, even if it's not something that right now today isn't being a large profitable part of the industry or anything like that, or what, something that is kind of being...
What specific industries, I mean, do you see really benefiting from this?
You want me to tell you guys them?
Sure. I mean, it's one of those that kind of you'll be at trade shows or just be talking to people, and they really once it clicks on like what we're doing, the imagination starts running, and everyone kind of runs to a lot of the similar more obvious ones like gaming. Obviously we've been talking about the added benefits of touch there, but I think some more subtle things that really make a huge difference is we were talking about in big screen here, when our hands touch, there's like that snap and like that little explosion that happens. But and
he means a metaphorical explosion, but a here we can touch it. We can touch each other and make the sound. There we go. When our hands touch in big screen, that's the sound of hands clapping, I suppose.
Right, you wouldn't need that.
But like in your kind of modern day office environment, you'll have a conference call and everyone kind of has that awkward, like, oh, who talks next? How does it, we know who's over, et cetera. But kind of in future VR, I mean, you'll be putting a headset on, having a conference call, kind of like we're doing right here with big screen, but you'll be able to actually shake the person's hand at the end and be able to feel that sensation and kind of close that deal and have a bigger sense of closure, which is why that in-person meeting is so important these days. As well as you can kind of digress or go back to more of like the research side of things and development side of things is in your human factors lab. I mean, if you're designing a car, that you want, when a car designer is working, they want the experience, the car to feel as comfortable as possible for the person sitting in it. I mean, they want to be able to reach all buttons as easy as possible. And really, if you're designing that car and able to actually use your fingers and hands and reach out and touch objects and know that this thing's here versus this other button versus this knob, it adds a whole extra layer to that design process. And then you're saving money on the end of prototyping to then realize that this was actually wrong in your simulation. And then so it really expedites and makes that entire process much smoother.
I think another really prevalent application that we want to touch on is mentioned slightly earlier in this conversation, training. That's one that a lot of people in the consumer space of VR right now, even on the dev side, don't really realize had supported a multi-million-dollar research industry for the headsets for couple of decades before we got to this consumer point of being able to push out units from big OEMs, was on the like training side from like DoD budgets and military applications. And I mean, you see things like even with the consumer headsets pushing those even further on the eyesight side. So like the Israeli force just started using an Oculus Rift experience for using like kind of tunnel specific maneuvers to avoid some of the newer tactics that Hamas was using against them in their recent conflicts. So there's been a giant backing for training from the military side to even in the like kind of enterprise application side of hand-based skills that you could teach. Those can't happen without a sense of touch. And they're like, we're talking about that memory coming from it. Mm. So we've seen like one application that could be is some of the larger contract manufacturers that are constantly putting people on the assembly line doing new tasks or putting people through or producing a new product this quarter than we were last for a contract manufacturer. So we have very different assembly lines, different procedures all the time. They spend a lot of money on putting people in kind of classroom-based trainings and then getting, you know, put right back on the floor with that expensive equipment in dangerous situations because maybe you don't know that lever B, you know, drops down this specific, you know, sharp apparatus that could almost guillotine a finger or something like that. Mm. We've seen a lot of interest from people who run those types of programs, being able to put someone in a VR headset and with a pair of gloves or a, you know, Leap Motion strapped on, use their actual natural hands and get that sense of touch to build that muscle memory of what it would be like without actually having the time cost of being on the floor using the equipment, having the time cost of individually going through with a trainer, having the functionality increase of actually being able to have hands-on use case of it before you're out there. And that scales past not even just like an assembly line worker, right? I mean, you see things like KFC or UPS integrating VR solutions for training right now. Some of them could be seen as a bit of a PR stunt, right? The KFC mm-hmm. one a bit. But you're seeing other companies like Walmart using very, very proven tactics of training employees inside of VR. And those are, you know, or on the QB side with, I usually get their name wrong. Is it Striver?
Yep, Striver.
Striver. Like, I mean, you know, they're the ones who are actually doing the system with Walmart. And so it's mostly based eye basement of like what you could see and what you could do and implement from that. And the levels of what you can add in a training standpoint when you have hands that are naturally feeling real, it's so much higher than what you can do with just the eyesight base there. So that's one of the like, the even like kind of more right away larger industries that can affect and kind of bring a higher level of VR capabilities.
Totally.
Another one we really like is the research side. So like, you know, the consumer habits of a company like, I mean, I guess Walmart would be another example here, but say, let's go Target. Just they mm-hmm. spend a good amount of money on putting together physical locations and scheduling events for people to come in and kind of see what the planogram of shelves would look like and give them consumer feedback on like what you would react to on the shelf, what you pick up, what you would actually bring to the checkout if you were actually shopping. If they could do that in a virtual world by not having the cost of physically setting up that thing and not having to require both having staff and testing subjects come through on a specific day, but they could just put up a virtual world that is a mock of that store that they could constantly have their designers running their assets through and changing and having people you know, scheduled throughout the week to go in and in my headset, look around how I would shop, what would I grab off, what would I feel, what would I pick up, what would attract me from like just, you know, having my hand against it, things like that, that get increasingly more significant in their functionality when you have, you know, higher levels of full body presence that can come from multiple senses like sight and touch working in tandem.
In terms of a timeline of when you'll be, I guess, delivering mm-hmm. these, where are you guys, you know, throughout the hardware cycle?
Mm-hmm. Yes, timeline wise, what we're on right now is over 2018 and over 2019, we want to continue some of our pilot programs, some of our kind of validation cycles that are working with some of the bigger enterprise users or some, as well as some of the smaller dev teams like we are currently to validate some of those specific applications as well as get those feedback so that in the end of 2019 timeframe, we can start what would be our kind of our full launch of that haptic IP license. So at that time, is when we would be trying to convince the headset people to be more integrating it in. And from there, it would be similar to kind of what you're seeing with the Knuckles right now, what you saw with Touch when they rolled out. We'd have to do about a year of a development cycle with devs having full product in their hand to create content that would be coming out in that, hopefully in that launch timeline of like very end of 2020, very beginning of 2021, that you would have, you know, the ability to buy X headset with, you know, X controller that has our sense of touch and a plethora of platform content behind it. Before then, you know, we are going to have smaller release units similar to like the alphas, where we have small batches going out to developers getting feedback. And also there's larger kind of pilot programs testing through with the enterprise applications. Full scale, really, like, you know, you as a consumer, you won't really see the device being out there until the 2020 timeframe. As a developer or as an enterprise user, much earlier in the kind of 2018 timeframes.
And if you're a developer, where can someone, you know, contact you?
Definitely. I would say a good spot for that is contactci.co. We have a text box there for reaching out. We you know, frequently communicate with different developers in the community through that portal on reaching out about, you know, what their interests would be or what when we could secure them getting access to a glove or an item. I think another, just as of right now, something that would be an interesting way another way to get in touch is our Seed Invest profile. So Seed Invest is a equity crowdfunding site. We actually are currently live and up on there doing a fundraising through there. There's a comment section and things like that there if you want to reach out on that. It's another way to get in touch currently. A third option would be info@contactci.co if you're looking for just an email to specifically type up a more long form thing about.
Cool. So and not a Kickstarter, not an Indiegogo, but a Seed Invest. I haven't tried that yet.
Correct. Yeah.
So it's pretty similar in the general concept of supporting a company that's running a campaign. The main difference being where with Indiegogo or Kickstarter, you're more of pre-ordering a product or contributing and getting some sort of perk at the lower levels of money.
Right.
Whereas with Seed Invest, you're investing in the company at a minimum of $500 with our campaign. But it's something that both Virtuix, the omnidirectional treadmill, has had some pretty good success through Seed Invest, as well as Resume, one of the VR bikes, has had success.
So I think that's really good kind of summation of why we chose Seed Invest over one of those more kind of known crowdfunding platforms. Is that equity crowdfunding kind of wording in front of it? It's a really important distinction for us. We feel like a lot of those, especially as a hardware company that's got a long-term vision, a lot of those kind of platforms don't incentivize the backers and the company to be aligned with that kind of full long-term goal that an actual angel investor or VC would be, based off of the chance of having financial return in the long term, right?
Kickstarter is all about.
Are we going to get a
right?
That product that's going to come right now.
That's a great point, actually.
So it opens us up to that the crowd that we, you know, a lot of people have asked us if we'd be open to those types of ways, but it keeps it like we're wanting that if someone wants to join this journey for kind of bringing in touch to the spatial computing world, that they are going to see a long-term return that is beneficial, the same way that we'd want someone that is committing to us long-term to see. It puts it in a way that we feel like as a platform itself, it communicates kind of all that we'd want to through the campaign really well, like what they have on their page and all that side of it, comparatively to some of the other ones, as well as, I guess the third main thing for us was Seed Invest's reputation specifically themselves. So as a crowdfunding equity-based site, there are others that are out there on that platform. They've been around since about 2013, have been one of the more successful ones in the sense they've had over 250 companies get fully funded through their campaigns on there. But they have more than 1,000 companies apply a month, and less than 1% of those get through the due diligence process to be on their page. They consider themselves a very highly strict vetting process. You know, you work with CPAs, members of their venture firm, members of their product firm, members of their marketing team, kind of going through what would your campaign be and why should we open our investor platform of more than 200,000 people up to your company and kind of put our backing behind it as well. So I just like that they're not just a marketplace that anyone can be put up on, but there is a kind of, hey, we believe in some level that this is a company that should be kind of getting this exposure, and we want to be pushing it out there. So we've gotten them through our due diligence process. So just that part of it, I think, was really important for us as well, because we didn't want it to be just if we're saying we want you to line term long term with us, we want you to have the full information and full understanding of what we're trying to do as a vision.
Very cool. How can people find and contact you? Greg?
Personally, I'm on Twitter, Facebook. I don't really Instagram much, but I'm there at @_F_Douglas. Douglas does have two S's on the end there. More like the Scottish spelling of the name. As well, email where I'm craig@contactsdi.co. Like I said, I'll be frequently updating comments on that Seedinvest page and paying attention there. Seedinvest.com. We're right there in the group of startups. I think it's something like /contactsdi/seed, but just specifically going to their site, it's easier to find.
Twitter and Facebook will be good. And Tom?
Yeah. And then, my Twitter is tfbuchanan4. And then for reaching out and getting through contacts pages, it's contact_CI on Twitter, Instagram, I think Facebook too. So feel free to reach out. Definitely check out our Seedinvest campaign.
Awesome. Thank you guys for joining us.
We also
us.
Have some really, really cool videos out there. So check those out if you're interested in seeing kind of a more visual of what we're talking about.
Are those up on YouTube?
YouTube.
Yep. Video. Have some on YouTube. Share them on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Definitely.
All right, guys. Thank you guys for being here. I am Oz Balabunyan. You can find me at AzadiWex, and you can follow Research VR at Research VR Cast on Twitter and on Facebook as well. So thanks, guys, for being here again.
Yeah, we appreciate you talking to us today, Oz. Great time, sir.
Bye.